kick ass. I'm all out of gum. You know what happened yesterday is that we started the day one of the Fast and Furious-a-thon. We started movie number one. Plan is to end number seven just as number eight's coming out sometime in April, I guess. So we kind of got to hurt. We kind of got to hurry.
Yeah. What'd you think of the first movie?
Not much.
Yep.
But it made me want to see the second one. I'll tell you that.
Oh yeah, I'm very.
Yeah,
intrigued.
I love. I can't wait for the second one.
Give me what's their angle? A lot of action in the cars. Is there women?
They're fast and they're furious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. A lot of nitro.
Vin Diesel's in it, and it's just as you can make fun of it just as much as you want.
It has odors with the nitro and the diesel.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
All kinds of gas.
I can't imagine what it smelled like on set. Have you ever been on a movie set of all your adventures? I bet you
have. Not a movie set. I've been around many video shoots. A couple of video shoots. One with Mellencamp, one with Kiss. Actually, two shots of Mellencamp.
Huh.
Were there a lot of flames on the Kiss set?
Yeah. Well, and what was tough, it was in the...
that's their bread and butter.
It was in the Kentucky Convention Center, which had a low ceiling. And so...
Speaking of that, did you have anything to do with the Great White Fire? Just yes or no?
No.
Okay.
And if you wanted to look up the definition of stupid, it was definitely that because, you know, how desperate is it when you've got an act like that that has to carry pyro when they're playing basically bars?
Yeah.
And what I understand, when that happened, and it should have never happened, I can't believe that the tour manager was stupid enough to take a dive for Jack White. Or Jack Russell.
Whatever his name is. Or Jack Russell.
On that and go to... You know, 100 people were killed because of stupidity.
That's right.
And when that happened, I was still working with what was then Clear Channel. And we got an email that day that we are not to talk about this.
Oh, geez, really?
Because Channel had nothing to do with it. Clear Channel Entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
But of all things, right on top of that was one of our booking conference calls. And somebody came up, in Detroit, we had this show last week, and we caught the tour manager walking in right before the show to place these down. And then somebody chimed in, and we heard the same thing in New Jersey like 2 days before. And what they were doing was literally not telling anybody until they brought
the pyros in, and then there wasn't anything. Okay.
I mean, imagine trying to shoot pyro off in this room.
In this
with
room.
An 8-foot ceiling.
Yeah.
And that ceiling is more like about 14 feet.
Mm-hmm. I know.
You know, as Ron White says, you cannot fix stupid. So,
You ever set off fireworks in a bathtub?
Not as far as you know.
Okay, all right.
What about you? Have you ever done that?
Oh, yeah.
You were going to tell me three things before we started. What were you going to tell me?
When Chick turns his hat around, he's doing three things. He's either getting a tattoo, watching a sporting event, or podcasting.
Or podcasting.
Wow.
Well, let's do it then. Welcome to the Chick McGee Show. And this week, Italian-American, man about town. They call him the godfather of live entertainment. I don't think they've ever called you that, but we're going to start today. How about that?
There's always a first.
Ladies and gentlemen, also, he was just on... Did I show you the newspaper?
No.
Front page story. Steve and I live in the same neighborhood. What did they call you? The concert king? The concert promoter? What was it? You didn't read the article,
yes,
Steve? Of course you did. What did the front page say? It said something like... Here, let me look. It said Steve Girardi, a lifetime of regret. No, what did it say? No, it said something. Anyway, it's Steve Girardi. And what do you do, Steve? Explain to me what you do.
Currently, I am a... I'm a middle agent in the entertainment business. And what I do is I will broker deals with name entertainers and book them and produce it if necessary. For private events, fundraisers, festivals, my casinos. I just this past weekend had Aretha Franklin in town.
The Aretha Franklin.
The Aretha Franklin. It was her first performance since last August.
And she also just announced that
her retirement.
She's going to be retiring. Yep.
Way to go, Steve.
So it was.
You
it
brought
was,
her out, and then she runs right back into retirement. Yes. Huh?
Well,
I don't think that.
She
was.
Had some major health issues.
Oh, does she really? And, how old is she?
She's 74. She'll turn 75 oh, wow. in March. Last wow. August, she had several dates on the books and went to go to the doctor or just was feeling an ailment, and they immediately told her to cancel all of her performances for the rest of the year.
Ugh. Oh, my gosh.
So we're sitting there with this big event for a local foundation, for Community Health Foundation, going, well, is that going to impact us? No. You'll be fine. You'll be good. Just let her get some rest. And so then she was supposed to play in Chicago in December, and a few days before the show, she postponed it because of weather concerns. So as you can well imagine, last week at this time, I was on pins and needles, hoping that we weren't going to have bad weather, and they decided she likes to have a down day before a show. So They were originally going to come to town on Thursday, but they changed and asked if they could come in on Wednesday, and yes, you can come to town. And so I went and greeted her when she got into town about 9:30. And
what does her rider look like?
You know, it's
Are you the one that has to read all that?
Yeah,
I do. And typically, when it comes to a corporate show, you're typically reading it with an attorney.
Really?
And a music writer just is so different from anything else that they read.
I guess the writer is most. Known by most people from the famous Van Halen in order.
That was a gotcha, by the way.
It was?
That was a gotcha on their writer because they just wanted
to see if promoters wanted to see if you were reading the writer.
Reading the writer. And so the follow-up gotcha on that was Billy Squire asking for those brown M&Ms if you had a Van Halen show the week before because they were both booked by the same agency, Premier Tart.
Van Halen famously said, we want M&Ms, but no brown ones or all brown ones. I forget which
one
way it was.
One bowl of M&Ms with brown ones removed.
Right. And so then Billy Squire followed it up with
wanting the brown M&Ms.
Wanted all the brown.
I think that lasted one tour, but
boy, Billy just can't get a break, can he? First the big pink video, the big pink shirt video, and then he wants all the brown M&Ms.
And, you know, when we had him in town for – I had booked.
Couldn't be a nicer guy.
The
Rip Fest. I met him once.
He was a great guy.
Great guy.
The show was great. Billy Squire is one of these unique rock stars that I think made his money, but kind of sort of went into hibernation.
You think he just got – was he disenchanted with the music business? Because his album, that the one that The Stroke came off of.
That was a huge album.
Oh, my God. It was
so
everywhere.
So well produced. You know, and that really came out at that dynamic time, you know, right on top of AC/DC releasing Back in Black. But you had that. Then you had Def Leppard, which if I'm not mistaken,
was it Pyromania?
Pyromania. But I think they were all produced by John Mutt Lang.
Mutt Lang, yeah.
But,
sure.
You know, when Squire was doing headline dates, he was always a bit of, you know, he was definitely the rock star.
Right.
And wanted the rock star treatment, and I get that. But, you know, he kind of just went off into this hibernation. And yet when I had him in town about it, oh, goodness, it must have been about 8 years ago, I couldn't have been just happier and just loved hearing that great music. And he played it just like the record. And he also didn't come out with an agenda or – well, I've got a new album where I'm working up some new material right now.
Right.
So he just came out and played the songs.
And enjoyed performing live.
He really did. Well, I almost wonder. I think sometimes you get performers that it's one thing for them to be in a studio setting, but it's another thing to perform live. And some just may not be into performing live. Now, these days, you have to perform live to make a living.
Oh, you have to. Yeah, with the downloading and everything.
Period.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
the streaming, rather.
And I think there's this false illusion, though, that so many rock stars or movie stars, maybe just because you were on this hit TV show or because you recorded this album, that you're rich. And when in reality is, I question that at times. You know, maybe sitting well, but also, what am I going to do
if this touring stops?
How am I going to pay the mortgage in 6 months? that. So
yeah. I mean, I think that, especially TV people, sometimes it might only be a 3 or 4 year series.
Exactly.
Maybe a band has one good album and they're able to pull a year and a half, maybe two, of touring on that. And then that comes out with the next one and they're gone.
Exactly. And you know, last night, the Grammys, which but, you know, I don't think we've had a great album. I think the last great album we're ever going to see is 21 by Adele.
I was going to say Adele.
Yeah, I
think that's just
going to
be the
that.
Last yeah. impact album, period. And we're now in an era more of singles and just put it together and here it is. You know, but you know, sadly, I'm not sure that people want to listen to a whole album. I read the Lefsetz letter, and I maybe read too much into it at times. But I agree with him on that. We're in more of an era where it's just you record a song, release it. You know, I think it's best to be on a Spotify or be on something like that. The prospect of
– See, I am and I guess it's my age and we're basically the same age. And I want to own the music. Okay. Even at this point, I want to own it. I want to download it. I want to have it. And I know I can stream it on Spotify or Pandora or whatever. But I don't know – and I'm sure that's a generational thing. But, I mean, Vibbert's 26 and three quarters and he – You stream everything, right?
Yeah, I'm still at the. Except
where John Mayer's concerned.
Yeah, but John Mayer has lately he's been releasing his music in waves, where it's four songs at a time because these great albums will be out one weekend and then just get
lost. Exactly, something's hot now and not so hot tomorrow. And you know, we started seeing that really in the '80s. You go back to the mid '80s. And you look at what happened with here comes REO leading with the ballad. Here comes Journey leading with the ballad. Here comes Foreigner leading with the ballad. And it suddenly, while they were trying to be top 40 bands, I think their audience kind of went on to other things and said, yeah, we still want to hear your great hits. Mm-hmm. We don't want to hear the new stuff. And then you really fast forward to the end of the 80s. You had releases by Paul McCartney and the Rolling Stones. Now, one of the albums was called – Rolling Stones released an album called Steel Wheels. Can you name a song off that?
No.
Can you name a song off that Paul McCartney album?
I can't even name that Paul McCartney album.
I think it was called – the song was Figure of Eight.
This is so – Figure of Eight.
Got Me Running in a
Figure of Eight is without a doubt one of my favorite – It's not my favorite Paul McCartney
song. It sounded like a complete throwback – Paul McCartney song from Ram.
Like
it could have been on Ram.
It really did. But it was like he grabbed you by the neck and threw you back into those times. Yeah, it was a great song.
And when McCartney was touring, and keep in mind, Here I Go Again, 27 years ago today, I was doing the first of two Paul McCartney shows at Market Square Arena.
Okay, let's get to that. Now, You're a little Stevie Girardi. You're growing up in Central Ohio, Jason. Do you know all this? We grew up in the same place.
Why did everyone who had talent in Ohio move to Indiana? Can I explain that? Seriously.
No.
Jeff,
yeah.
You don't even understand some of the people before you.
Yeah, we got
that,
out.
The Michael Youngs, the Jamesons.
Marty Bender.
We're all from Ohio.
Tom's
still there. Yeah, but it's –
Pat Carlini was from Ohio.
Okay,
that one breaks the mold. But my point is – I'm kidding. Patty. No, but Steve Girardi started at Eastmore High School in a suburb of Columbus, Ohio. Mm-hmm. Tell these young whippersnappers who you went to school with or thereabouts.
Well,
or high school. You went to high school.
In high school, a year before me was Duncan Griffin. 2 years before me was Ray Griffin. And
Blake Griffin.
Archie Griffin. Archie Griffin.
Wow. I never met Archie Griffin.
Two-time Heisman Trophy winner from the Ohio State University.
Yep. And on Archie Griffin's first carry, he fumbled the ball.
At Eastmore or at Ohio State?
At Ohio State.
No kidding?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
Boston College. Never played football again after that.
Right.
No, he won the Heisman Trophy twice.
Debatable.
So you go to Eastmore. Did you go to Ohio State? You didn't go to
Ohio
State.
No, I learned my chops on High Street.
South High Street. Or North High. I'm sorry, North High Street.
At the Agora, 1722 North High Street.
The Agora. Tonight, it's
the gods.
The gods with a
opening act shakedown, who I managed.
G-O-D-Z.
You never told me you managed Shakedown.
Yes, these
are,
I did.
These are all.
I didn't tell you, but yes, I did. That was my first.
I probably. You know what the odds are that I was at a show that you were at in the mid 70s in Columbus, Ohio?
We were regulars at the Sugar Shack.
There was the Sugar Shack. There was the Agora. There was the Beer Stube. There was Mr. Brown's. Mr. Brown's.
You know, on a Friday.
Mr. Brown's Descent.
And on a Friday. And, you know, on a given weekend, it was common to have Strongbow at Mr. Brown's.
Yes, yes.
The Gods or Rosie at the Agora.
G-O-D-Z and Rosie, another great band.
Then at Zachariah's Red Eye Saloon, formerly the Castle.
I don't remember it was the
McGuffey
Castle.
Lane.
McGuffey Lane was a great. These are all.
Wow.
McGuffey Lane, Phil Dirt and the Dozers.
Phil Dirt.
Spittin' Image with. What was the girl I had the crush on at Spittin' Image? Mimi Rousseau. That's right.
I believe she still performs around, and so does John Schwab.
Bless her heart. Bless his heart. My goodness.
What theater remains there in Columbus? Well, it's right off of Ohio State.
It's the Newport Music Hall.
I've been there.
The old Agora.
That's the old Agora. Okay, I've been there.
And yeah, I just
I would go see a show.
Yeah,
I would love to have.
It was
Bob
a good Schneider. Venue. Real good venue.
Why don't you book Bob Schneider?
I'll do it right now
at the at Newport. And what you know, Newport's where my father grew up. That's the name of the little city he grew up.
Okay.
This is all coming together. Okay, so you graduate from Eastport. You go out into the world, and you're going to manage bands.
I tried to go to college. My father died when I was a senior in high school, and you know, I just was a little mixed up. Tried to go to college. I wasn't into the college thing, but I had this thing for wanting to be around the entertainment business. I attended a rock concert on May 13th of 1974 at St. John's Arena.
St. John's Arena.
Home of the Ohio State Buckeyes.
Yes, sir.
And
it they was, call it the it shop was, now? Or the
well, no, no. That's a separate building.
Yeah, it's a different building now.
Okay. See, St. John's was built, probably early 50s, but St. John's Arena was a one-dimensional venue. It was a basketball arena.
It's something you don't see anymore.
You couldn't rig off the roof there. You had to literally do what's called ground support.
It was because of the side of the building. It was so steep. It was crazy.
Well, it's a steep venue. It holds like 13,000 people, but you cannot put, you know, you cannot rig or hang production in there. But I saw Edgar Winter there, and I got bit by the bug.
Wait a minute. 1974, Edgar Winter.
With Rick Derringer
drumming. With Rick Derringer. Steve, I was at that show. Yeah. That was one of the touring.
They only come out at night.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Dan Hartman was in Rick Derringer's band.
Hartman was on bass.
Oh my!
Or I believe I'm
Jason. I was at the show.
But the opening act. This is, you're going to love this chick.
I don't remember.
The James Gang featuring Tommy Bolin on lead guitar.
Yes.
With this song, "It Must Be Love."
My best friend in the world, Billy. I still call him Billy. They call him Bill now. Bill McMillan. And I went to that show at St. John's Arena. His mom dropped us off, and she came back.
John
and picked
Kramer's
us up.
Mother dropped us off.
Oh, Steve! Oh,
that's crazy.
Yes,
but I have the best.
I was 15 years old.
I have the best first concert in the history of the world. The opening act at Hare Arena in Dayton, Ohio, which just recently closed. That was a sad. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hare Arena was always.
And we're going to talk about Hare Arena in a second.
Okay, all right. Hold that story. But first act was Bad Company. This is 74. Bad Company, the Black Album come out. And then JoJo Gunn was the middle.
Getting kind of cocky.
And Black Oak, Arkansas was the headliner at Hare Arena in Dayton, Ohio.
And see, and actually, that show was in the summer of 75.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Okay, you're better at dates than I am on this.
Well, I'm sorry, the summer of 74. The summer of 74 was that show.
Okay, so which show was I at first?
You would have been at the Edgar Winter show first.
First, okay, so that was...
Yeah, that was in May, and
that's our first concert. I knew it, Steve.
Yeah. I went to see that same show at the Fairgrounds Coliseum in Columbus.
Oh, I never saw a show at the Fairgrounds Coliseum.
Yeah, I saw a couple.
Is that worth it? No, hang on. I saw Cheap Trick or was that St. John's?
It's coming back to me now.
Or was it Jay Giles? Maybe I think Jay Giles.
Jay Giles played there. And do you know who the opening act was?
Jay Giles.
Do you know who the opening act was?
No.
You too.
Did I say you too?
I did.
Oh, you must have.
What
that
year?
Wasn't me.
This was about 1979 or 80.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was back there. Yeah. That was the boy.
And then U2
had a record called
Boy. Then U2 came back on that record and played at the Agora in 80 or 81.
Wow.
Okay. All right. This is my the most excitement I get out of this podcast. Okay. That's mine and Steve's first concert. Jason, your first concert?
I believe it was the fall of 87.
Be thinking, Vibbert. You're going to be up next.
Rupp Arena.
Rupp Arena.
My favorite venue ever.
No kidding?
My favorite arena ever.
How many states have you booked shows in? Just the Midwest? I'm sorry. We'll be back to you, Jason.
It's fun.
Is it like Kentucky, Ohio, all of them, Indiana?
When you factor in every state, I'm probably...
Because you worked for Sunshine, which is a massive...
Sunshine was really Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee. We would reach into West Virginia sometimes. We reached down to Puerto Rico. I went down there about 30 times.
No kidding.
And sometimes I would do maybe a comedy show in Michigan. I did Stephen Wright up there a couple times. Mm. Sandy Patty, I reached out to Nebraska.
Oh, my gosh.
Done corporates in California, Las Vegas, Florida, Georgia. But Rupp Arena.
Holy moly.
Hold
yes.
on. I want to see if I did this show.
Oh, okay.
All right. The Marley, the young Marley, Ziggy.
Ziggy Marley.
Opened up for In Excess.
I knew you were going to say In Excess. I did that show. And they were, you want to talk about a great live band was In Excess.
This is my first show.
You want to talk about
nuts.
A miserable band offstage was In Excess.
Yeah. No kidding.
I believe it.
Hutchins was a pain
those
in the ass.
Those guys were so good live.
Yeah.
And I think they kind of shot themselves in the foot a little bit when they peaked out, they made some money.
Oh, yeah. They were huge.
And then they
that
just kind of wanted
huge.
To –
Well, that one guy had a lot of regrets. It made him want to, you know, kill himself.
Well – that album was called
yeah.
There's Need You Tonight is on it.
My favorite
It was a one word album. It was a one word name. It was Kick.
Kick. That's it.
Kick.
Yep. And it was a Suicide Blondes on that, is that right?
There was a great they were such a great live band, Australian band.
We've got to hear Figure of Eight, this podcast. We got to hear my favorite In Excess song. Okay, Ziggy Marley and In Excess. Vibbert, first show.
This is his first?
First live concert.
John Mayer, 2008, Verizon Music Center.
And you didn't want to go.
Didn't want to go.
Well, and you know what? I think John Mayer's touring with this
band
right now.
Yeah, the Grateful Dead, yep.
So. Oh, are you? All right. Is he
dead income? Dead income.
Yeah. So he's playing guitar with him, right?
Yeah, they started calling him John Slayer because he was doing so well.
You know, really embraced John Mayer probably had the last great record deal, too.
Really?
Because when he was starting to come out, when he was coming onto the scene, it was, I think, late 90s or early
early is right about 2000.
His first album was 2001.
Yeah.
And it just sounds like somebody got hot on this guy, and suddenly you had the record labels chasing him. You had booking agents and managers chasing him. And I believe he made a massive impact at South by Southwest that year.
Mm-hmm. It sounds right.
But John
– His first album –
So Room for Squares.
High school, whatever the song about high school. That's what I call it, high school.
Yeah.
Because he's going to show them all in high school. I love that first album. But it was like didn't he redo a lot of those songs for that album from an earlier album?
A few of them, right?
Is that right?
Yeah. Inside Wants Out. It was an EP.
It is fascinating, Steve. It was crazy how you hear about this guy and you already knew this guy is going to be huge.
Yeah.
Just as a consumer of music, you just knew.
And when South by Southwest was just kind of in its infantile stage then,
right.
But that was the buzz coming out of it. And it must have been right after – it had to have been around the year 2000 because that was when we were – You know, Sunshine sold to SFX. We were the second promoter to sell to them, and I think they wish they would have been the fifth or sixth. But then Sillerman sold his concert promoting company, SFX, to Clear Channel. And that was when it became Clear Channel Entertainment.
Right.
But the buzz going on then was John Mayer. And, of course, I'm thinking, who is John Mayer? Would you please pass the AC/DC to me?
Yeah.
You know, can I get a side of Bob Seger with that?
Right.
But there was a definite buzz on John Mayer, and rightfully so. I mean, he's I've never seen him, but
I've never seen him live, but I have a ton of respect for the guy. I've got a feeling I'm going to.
Oh,
I can't wait.
You have to.
So to emphasize your point, there was so much competition to get him. He got a really good record deal.
He got just a massive record deal, one of the last big money record deals.
Really.
And you know, I don't think we're ever going to see big money record deals again. I think you're going to see more like big money sponsor deals. I think you're going to see
like Ray-Ban sponsoring whoever,
or a Garth Brooks aligning with a Walmart as an example. I think you're going to see that to an extent. But I think so much of it is more streaming and portability. You know, let's face it. All of us right now have a phone here, and that's where I think this is where
if you took this phone, if I didn't have access to a phone for longer than the longest I go without my phone is when I switch to a new phone.
Yeah,
and it freaks me out during that process.
Well, just last night,
my whole life is on this phone.
I don't know if James Corden was correct, but he talked about Ed Sheeran, how he went 8 months without a phone or internet this past year and just wrote music.
Interesting.
Ed Sheeran's on fire. Yeah. Ed Sheeran is.
I don't know how much how serious I could take James Corden. I'm just.
Right.
I think that was just a sham the way they tried to be funny and
do
all that.
The intro was terrible.
You know what? If it's Grammys, it should be about music. It should not be about production. It shouldn't be about choreography. It shouldn't be about anything. It should be about playing music and trying to play it live.
That's true.
But
they want it to be a TV show.
I just wanted to inject my opinion.
Yeah.
So let's get more into Steve's story, Chick.
What was your first job? You wanted to be a concert promoter.
Well, I was working at Focus Magazine.
Do what?
Focus Magazine. It was the free entertainment paper.
Focus? Was that in Columbus?
Yes.
How have I never heard of that magazine?
It was Focus was out, and I—
And this is in 77, 78?
76.
Okay.
I was in high school still.
Right.
And I was doing circulation, which meant I would bring piles of them into record stores.
Right.
And then after I turned 18 in December of 76, I became the guy that would go out and review local bands.
Oh, like so I had the kid from Almost Famous.
Okay.
And so Cameron Crowe.
Suddenly, I am going out to Joe's bar and checking out this band or that band and writing about it.
And the acts are the acts starting to find out, oh, here's this kid who's going to review the show tonight, so we need to – oh my God, this is Almost Famous.
Yeah. And it really was kind of a door opening thing. And from that, I.
Did you work for like Jam and all those guys?
You know what? I was a runner for Jam, Belkin, and Sunshine.
Okay.
And I.
Is that like more or less like an intern?
A runner is the very entry job. But I had, you know, become friends with a guy named Mark Chatfield. And Mark Chatfield played guitar in The Gods.
Okay, I was just going to say he's one of those band guys from
And eventually
Central Ohio.
Mark played for 20 years with Bob Seger's band up until a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And but from that was when I met the guys in the band Shakedown. And one day Phil Stokes just pulls me off to the side and, hey, man, I think you ought to manage us. Like, what do I know about managing? But you got a business thing. I do not. I also worked at Bill Swad Chevrolet at that time.
Bill Swad. Bill Swad.
55 East Main Street.
Bill Swad Chevrolet. Bill Swad. For those of you from Central Ohio, I don't know who else is digging this, man, but I am. Bill Swad was like a car dealer.
And a preacher. And a
very successful car dealer. But then he became a preacher.
What?
And he was like a born-again, charismatic.
Wow.
Yeah.
Charismatic's a great way to word him. I always liked Mr. Swad.
Yeah, he was something else, man. And if you went on his lot and looked at a car, if you didn't buy a car, there was something wrong with you.
You're going to hell.
Because Bill was like the shit, man.
And then the Shakedown got to open for the Babies at the Agora.
And John Waite and the Babies, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And I
Was there any other Babies? No.
Met somebody from Sunshine at that time, and they said, well, why don't you become our runner? A guy named Bob McCutcheon, who's still around town here.
I was just going to say that's a familiar name. Okay.
So I started running for being a showrunner in Columbus and Dayton. And they said, do you know Dayton? I said, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I didn't even know where Dayton was. Absolutely. And
Hera
Arena was built See, when Jesus was doing the Sermon on the Mount,
right.
Well, they wanted to tour it back then. And so many places in America thought,
right.
And they wanted to add a North American leg, and many places thought, let's build a venue and see if we can get a date. And Harrow Arena was built specifically for that,
yep.
And they never updated it since then.
No, they didn't touch it.
No.
God love them. They didn't move one speck of dust from Harrow Arena.
You know, one of the things about it, we did so many rock shows. Dayton was such a great rock market.
Oh, Dayton is still a great
rock market. But what always cracked me up with Harrow Arena was the catering, because it was in-house catering, and the food that was uneaten, they would just take and put in the freezer.
Yep.
So if you had a show in there and you had their barbecued ribs,
I think Steve,
they had the leftover ribs from the
Steve, we did the Bob and Tom Comedy Tour and hit Harrow Arena a couple of times, and those ribs were in the refrigerator.
They just,
I'm sure,
or
of
the
it.
Chicken, they just, when the uneaten stuff was just taken and thrown in the freezer, and then the next time
it
that came up, it was labeled, they pulled it out. And if I know that for a fact, because I got to go in that freezer one time.
Before we go any further, you said you wrote reviews for bands. Did you ever write any negative reviews, or were you too scared?
I didn't. It was more or less
puff piece, hey, and you got to come see this band.
Such and such in the,
Mark Chatfield and the Gods. You got to come see them, right?
Or something, maybe not something like that. Yeah, and just what a great show, and they're going to be at the Al Rosa Villa, or they're going to be at Dixie Electric Company.
Oh my God, Dixie Electric Company! I'm freaking out.
Or here, this is going to be a good one. Chick, ready?
Yep.
The Yellow Lion in Gahanna.
Oh my God! The home of the Gahanna Lincoln. What's the high school there? Gahanna Lincoln Wildcats.
I'm not sure what their team name
was.
Yeah,
I think they're the Wildcats. Gahanna Lincoln.
You want to know an interesting story about the Yellow Lion? Is it's the only time I've ever seen a band buy their own nightclub, and the band Pure Jam bought that bar. Now Pure Jam had a singer named Joey Mellencamp.
Oh, really? Okay. Was that John's dad?
Brother.
Oh, his brother.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. And, I did not know.
And it's the only
this.
Time you ever saw, and they were a great band, but the only time you ever saw a band buy their own bar, have their own venue, and I think for good reasons, it just wasn't in the cards. But I saw Joey, I was with with Richard Mellencamp, John's dad, or their dad.
That's his dad.
About 8 years ago, and I, introduced myself to Joey because I never saw him when we did Mellencamp shows in the 80s and 90s.
Did you just freak him out?
And just said, man, I remember the Yellow Light. Like, oh, I lost so much money on that. And
oh, really?
But, yeah. So
is that the first time you met John, like 8 years ago? Or, you ran shows for him, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was in – let me think this out here.
Well, when did you come to Indianapolis
84.
And start working here?
May of 84.
Okay. Well, so what brought you here?
Well,
Sunshine Promotion.
Sunshine Promotion.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
you and John Vallant and mm-hmm. Dave
God
Lucas.
Rest his soul. Well, Dave Lucas and Steve Sebesma owned
Sebesma.
The company.
That's it.
And
then we were there when they, I think that might have been the first time I met you or pretty close to it. When they opened up, it'll always be Deer Creek to me.
Deer Creek opened on May of 89, and I booked the first show at Deer Creek. It was Sandy Patty.
Sandy Patty at Deer Creek.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah.
And if you were to ask me to this day what the three most important shows were to ever play Deer Creek, I would say Sandy Patty, which was on, I think, May 22nd.
1989. Yeah.
Frank Sinatra on July 1. And Grateful Dead on July 15. And the reason I say
– wait a minute. July – this is all 89. Okay.
And the reason I say
– Sinatra played Deer Creek in 19 – I had no idea. Okay.
Sunshine lost over $100,000, closer to $150,000 on Frank Sinatra. But
was that his guarantee? Was that his guarantee, Steve?
It was a lot more than that. But I'm just saying
– tell us what his guarantee was? He's dead, Steve. Frank's dead. $500,000 for Frank.
Quarter of a million dollars.
That's out the door to get Frank Sinatra.
And this is an 89. That's like $1 billion.
So he didn't care how many tickets you sold.
They really didn't. Frank Sinatra was not one that was good at. You just didn't see Frank Sinatra go on a regular tour. If somebody would book him, they didn't really solicit dates on him as much as they wanted to play the New York, the Miami, the Chicago, the Las Vegas type things. But if you suddenly. If somebody would reach out and book him, if you would meet the terms and meet the money, they were going to go play, and then they may try to pick up a couple of dates around it.
Okay.
But And Frank Sinatra was a good building opener. They, when they redid the Roberts Stadium, the arena in Evansville, they brought in Frank Sinatra as an example.
Okay, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. So no, but, Frank Sinatra, Sandy Patty,
and
Grateful
Dead.
Dead.
And I think the reason I say that is Sandy Patty was our first show.
Mm-hmm.
Just you had to get started. That was a perfect show to get started with.
Do you remember what a struggle that was to open that venue? I mean, there were the sound ordinances and the people around.
Well, here's the interesting thing about when that group called RAD, Residents Against Detrimental Development, I think they just were attention seeking, and I think that the attorney that they had, John Price, mm-hmm. I think.
Who has recently passed,
God rest his soul. But I think they were just trying to position themselves for what I do not know.
Well, at the time we knew, and this is all speculation, and I certainly have nothing but the utmost respect for Mr. Price, but he wanted to be in the public line. He was going to make a run for public office, and that's simply – I mean, I'm –
It sure quadrupled Bob and Tom's ratings.
And in the final outcome, him protesting the Bob and Tom show and having someone in the crowd call me a baby killer for whatever reason. I still don't remember why. It did nothing but quadruple our ratings. Yeah.
And when you go back to this – You know, these accusations they were making, like that we were going to have 80 concerts in a year, like Motley Crue.
All these damn hippies. And
I remember the comeback being, there aren't 80 shows to book.
That's true.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, and well, the cows are going to give off bad milk, except that wasn't the case.
Well, and it's Indiana. Look around. You can't have outdoor shows except April, May, May, June, July, August.
There was actually – we were welcomed by the farm that was next to us, Harger, loved having – seeing that development go in there. And actually one time during a show, I think, during setup, one of the cows got out and came onto the property. You know, and we told him the cow is fine, but he has to stay up in the grass area if he wants to watch the show.
That's right. And if he wants to get backstage with Sinatra's here, he's going to need a pass. Okay.
But, you know – one of the things about the noise ordinance was we had our first show with Sandy Patty. The very next day we had Cinderella, okay?
Wow.
And not the Broadway show, the rock group,
Cinderella.
That's right.
Which I still thought that album of theirs was a really good album.
Are you sure? You don't want to go back and look at that statement you just made?
I thought it was a good album. Okay. I really did. Long Cold Winter I thought was a great album.
Oh, okay. All right.
But okay. So Cinderella had the old Tasco PA, which was the really hard rock PA. That was the PA you would see Judas Priest and Iron Maiden carrying. It was
the You weren't big, a rock and roll band unless you had the Tasco.
Yeah, this was a big British PA.
Yep.
And, you know, the setup was so quick that day. During the afternoon, it was a Sunday afternoon. I asked their then production manager, Ron Anderson, I haven't had contact with this guy in years. I said, do me a favor. I want to go out to our property line with our Dolby meter, decibel meter.
Oh, okay.
I want you to fire the PA as hard as you can. And I remember saying this to their sound man, Laurie Quigley, who still is one of the great rock and roll sound men, Australian guy. Laurie punched the PA up as hard as he could in the pavilion. It was hitting around 122 in the pavilion.
Oh, God.
Yet at our property line.
Right.
It was more like 90, and the ordinance was 75 decibels a half mile from the property line. So right then we knew we are never going to hit this.
Right.
So
legally, you were.
And there was also the curfew thing, which we were supposed to be over by 10:30 on weekdays, 11 o'clock on weekends.
Oh, I thought it was 11 o'clock on weekdays too. Oh, okay. I didn't know it was.
You know what? You may be right. Maybe it was 11 and 11:30.
I thought it was 11 and 11:30.
But the only time we ever got hit on it was Guns N' Roses. It was, it was a tough thing. One of the toughest things we did was our second year opening up with two nights of Guns N' Roses, because we were coming off Memorial Day weekend, and
Memorial Day weekend in Indianapolis is race
huge.
Weekend,
and especially then. But you're coming off that.
And
suddenly,
that was before the split, so yeah.
And suddenly here we are with two sold-out shows at 18,000 cap, but the problem was you had staff that just weren't in acclimated with things. So you had people parking cars that you know, had no real experience at it or hadn't been in practice of it. You had concession workers and on, and suddenly here we are, boom, being hardly – you know. And that's something else you have to take into hard consideration. I think one of the most brilliant things we did was bringing in the staff at Market Square Arena to manage Deer Creek. And to this day, I still think Rick Fusen is the best building manager – well, president of the Patriots now – ever. Mm-hmm. I think he was better at his job than Michael Jordan ever was at his job.
Wow.
Steve Girardi is our guest. He's a concert promoter and rock star glad hander and knows everybody and everything about everybody. And I'm just remembering, I have seen John Mayer in concert.
With Sheryl Crow.
With
Counting Crows.
It was at, yes, Counting Crows, like a couple years ago at Deer Creek.
Round here.
Yeah.
Apparently.
I don't know why I forgot that.
Apparently John Mayer at the hotel, all those musicians were down in the hotel drinking. This is before John Mayer was John Mayer.
Right.
And he stood up on his chair, very drunk, and just yelled, "Everyone here needs to take care of the wait staff. They're working very hard." What a great guy.
See, this is the kind of story Steve will tell us here coming up when we come back.
That's my one story.
Steve, can you stay for another couple hours? You all right? You live right here. You're fine.
I got another hour.
Yeah. Okay, we'll take a break and we'll come right back.
Can I tell them about this
please
first?
Please do, okay. This is important, Chick.
This is important as a listener.
If you love Chick McGee, it's important.
If you love the Chick
How
McGee show.
How can you not love Chick McGee?
Thank you, Steve Girardi. I appreciate that. You need to, quite honestly, help this podcast stay free to download with minimal ads that you're hearing. They're wonderful people who advertise on the Chick McGee Show. But here's what we need you to do. Help us help you to help these advertisers align the appropriate advertisers to the Chick McGee Show. There's a survey that you need to take, and I know what you think. Survey? No, honest to God. It's short and completely anonymous. It won't take you 5 minutes. There are two easy ways to start the survey. Just go to podcastone.com, my survey, or podcastone.com and click on the survey banner. And if you filled out the survey in the past, we appreciate you listening before the Chick McGee Show was part of the Podcast One family. Please go back. Please especially do that. Go and fill it in again and mark everything that you can, Chick McGee.
I'm a big fan of surveys. I almost feel like it's...
They do make a difference, especially now.
It's better than voting.
It really
I feel like it's representative of what I like and feel, and you get your word in. You get your feelings put into yes, it's with everybody else's, but it does influence what happens.
Honestly, we've as even back in the days off the air with Jess and the Chick McGee Show, we've never asked. We've never asked for money. We've never asked for donations.
We've begged a little.
Even though there's a donation banner on chickmcgee.com, we'd appreciate it. But if you could do this for us, for me.
Can I start with $5?
Can you do me a solid?
Put it on the table.
Vibber, get that $5. Go to podcastone.com, click on the survey banner, or go to podcastone.com/mysurvey. Fill out the survey, answer every question you can with Chick McGee. You do all of us at the Chick McGee Show and Podcast One a huge favor by filling this out. And honestly, you help the Chick McGee Show it. And Jason offsets, sure, for me and Jason and Steve, our lives are practically over. But think about poor little Jeff Vibbert, who's going to have to take this and rebrand this whole thing into the Jeff Vibbert Show.
You know, Jeff, I've seen you perform.
Please give me money.
See, you opened for April Macy.
I did.
Yes, yep. You did.
Yeah.
He killed it, didn't he?
Wait, did you enjoy it?
You were very funny.
That was me.
The memory on this guy.
That was Jeff Vibbert. So please go to podcastone.com/mysurvey or podcastone.com, click on the survey banner, fill it out, and do all of us here at the Chick McGee Show a favor. We appreciate it. Thank you very much. And we'll be back with more of Steve Girardi, concert guy.
Is your basement or garage full of old house paint that you know you'll never use? I know mine is. Avocado green, hot pink, antique white. That is a nice shade of white, though. You know, it's easy to recycle your leftover paint, stain, and varnish all over California. Most paint care drop-off locations are paint and hardware stores that take back leftover paint. Keep what you need and recycle the rest. Find a drop-off site near you at paintcare.org.
Mm-hmm.
I was too early.
Oh,
here we go.
Oh, you got me dancing in a figure of eight.
Hi. Welcome back to the Chick McGee Show.
I haven't heard this in forever.
No. And so...
Steve Girardi's our guest. Go, Steve.
So when McCartney toured in late 89, 1990,
right.
This was the opening song.
And this is the first song he did.
This was the first song okay. they did. And what was really interesting with that Paul McCartney production was they didn't have a stage per se as much as they had three moving risers that were on tracks that would all move.
So it could come... They just moved
sideways.
Back and forth.
Right to left.
Right to left.
It was really kind of interesting. And behind them, they had these massive video screens.
Yeah.
They had three
right.
that were rear projector fed with these big 35-millimeter projections. Mm. So one of the things that you had to do was you had to kind of build the stage out a little bit to accommodate this, except in Rupp Arena, which it was just... By hook or crook, it was designed perfectly for this show, of all things.
You just lucked out. I think he just recently played Rupp Arena again.
He may have.
Not long ago, yeah.
And so
I think he likes the venue.
On this tour, the night would start with a video, like this roughly 10, 12-minute video. And the video started with that Hard Day's Night. It's been a
Right.
And it was a Beatles thing, and it jumped around. And then it eventually went to N-O-W, and here would come the band fading into that. And
Can you start the song again?
So it would have this.
So all that Beatles, and then it would come in
and go N-O-W.
Now
lights on, Paul McCartney.
This is such a great song.
Yeah,
I think I discovered the song moving from Broad Ripple into my first home in 19...
And radio 90? Played this, and I just don't think it went over that well.
Don't think it did either.
And what was interesting was we had... we were supposed to do four shows with McCartney in February of 1990. We did Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, that's right.
We did Cincinnati.
You and I are from Ohio, Steve. That never
then
changes.
A couple days off. And it was going to be two here on February 13, 14.
Right.
And then I want to say 16 or 17 was going to be Rupp Arena.
Okay.
And McCartney stayed at that resort down in Bloomington.
Four Winds.
He stayed there the whole time.
Really?
Yes. And I actually got... They needed a bus to move around, and so I got Sandy Patty's bus, and they rented it from her.
Oh.
Except they smoked pot on her bus. And anyways.
Were you a hero because you got Paul McCartney the bus and everything?
I think so.
Did you talk with him?
Yeah,
I
got to meet him each show.
Hello, Paul. How are you, Steve?
Actually, I presented him. I had to present things to autograph, and one of the things he autographed was my original Meet the Beatles album. And he commented, this is the original album. I said, but that's mine. He said, I'm going to personalize it for you. And Ringo Starr signed it also. And Ringo Starr, when he would see albums that were signed by McCartney, he would sign the opposite side of it. But Ringo was Ringo Starr was very approachable, by the way, when he played at Deer Creek.
Peace and love.
And
Until recently, he's been very approachable.
Well,
I think he's
kind of
changed.
But jumping back to this McCartney thing real quick. So – at that time, he was trying to play some new music, and he would also play some ballads. And it was a long show. It was just about a 3-hour show with no intermission. And McCartney would notice, and especially if you think about Market Square Arena back in the day, he would notice when he would hit his new music or when he would hit one of his just soapy ballads that people were getting up and going to the concession stand or the restroom.
Sure.
But he would also notice when he was playing the Beatles stuff or his recognizable stuff more off the 70s that they were standing and cheering.
Right.
So the set list was the same set list every night. But when we had this postponed show from Lexington that was postponed from I want to say it was February 16 or 17 to around April 10th. I think it was April 10th because that was my brother's birthday.
Okay.
Still is.
And he had a...
This is the way Steve tells the story.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I love it. He had a different... The set list had been modified, and he had thrown out like five or six of these songs and added more Beatles songs into it. Thus, the crowd was more active.
They liked the show more.
Mm-hmm. Chick, that album came out June of 89.
Yeah, June of 89. And McCartney and the Stones both released albums right at about that same time.
I remember
time.
Steel Wheels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't really. You got me rocking on Steel Wheels? Somebody look that up. Okay, so what is the first show you promoted at that you were in charge of? It's a Steve Girardi production.
Motley Crue. A real band.
Yeah,
and opening
right
opening act Saxon down in Evansville.
Oh, my Lord. At that arena that you were
talking
about?
Well, it was supposed to be at Mesker, but we had to move it. Mesker was the outdoor place. That was also another place that was built for the Sermon on the Mount tour.
Right.
God, am I glad that joke worked.
Yeah.
But Roberts Stadium was the indoor arena that they redid in the late...
And what year was that, Steve?
84. That was my first show. Was 1984. 10 years to the day of... I saw Edgar Winter May 13th of 74, produced Motley Crue May 13th of 84.
And in between 74 and 84, you were a runner, you managed bands, you... You made connections.
Sold cars. I moved to California.
You moved to California?
I moved here from San Francisco. I had moved out and worked for my girlfriend at the time.
Oh.
Her name is Patricia Fripp. And Patricia is
Any
a motivational
relation to
speaker.
Robert?
That's her brother.
Robert Fripp?
That's
yeah.
her.
No
Robert
kidding.
Is her younger brother, yes.
No kidding.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the only celebrity that Steve Girardi has personal family contact with. Go ahead, tell these young gentlemen who your first cousin is, right?
Bev D'Angelo.
Beverly D'Angelo, the mom.
Of D'Angelo Plastics?
No, it's from National Lampoon's Vacation.
Yes.
Well, she was...
She's the one who says Sparky.
Yeah. Yeah, and she was also in Coal Miner's Daughter. She did all that
She's
vocal
a great,
work.
Oh, she played
did vocal... She
Patsy,
played Patsy Cline.
Patsy Cline in actually
Paternity.
The one thing that either when you're a friend with somebody, you either when something like this happens, you either get closer or you never speak to this person again. And one morning on the air, I was joking around about Beverly D'Angelo, and I was teasing about how gigantic her boobs were, or something like that. I forget what it was. And all of a sudden, I get this text, and I didn't even know you had my phone number. I get this text from Girardi. That's my first cousin.
Cool it. That's my first
cousin. I cool I that. I thank you very much if you wouldn't talk about my first cousin
that.
Like that. And I looked down and I went, okay, he's fucking with me. This can't be. And we talked, and Beverly D'Angelo's dad ran Channel 10 in Columbus.
Well, he was president of Wolf Broadcasting, which had the CBS affiliate, WBNS in Columbus, and the NBC affiliate here, WTHR.
Oh, I didn't know those two were. Are they?
And they also owned the. I think they are. They may be.
Are they?
And
really?
They also owned the Ohio Company, which was a big brokerage firm, and the Columbus Dispatch. So BNS stood for banks, newspapers, and stocks. And they owned the Ohio National Bank.
Did they really?
Wow.
Is that what that's
called
for?
Did. Yeah.
Okay, 84. You do Motley Crue, and then what happens? Who's the most famous guy you meet or gal right off the bat?
Motley Crue wasn't huge.
They were just starting to take off.
They really hit it about what 87 is.
I think they were hitting Girls was 86.
Tommy Lee was writing Girls. Okay, no, I don't know.
You know, right after that, the Sports Center. You know, we went into season at the Sports Center, and
I never attend. I'm proud to say I never attended a show at the Sports Center.
They had a tough decision at Sunshine because on June 30th of 84, we had Van Halen. With the 1984 tour up in Fort Wayne, and we had Grateful Dead here.
At the Sports Center?
At the Sports Center.
This is before the outdoor venue.
I've got to tell you, Grateful Dead playing at the Sports Center was just like having a group of Black Panthers and a group of KKK people get together and let's have some cake and milk and punch and let's just have a good old time here. I mean, that didn't.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was –
I was at one Grateful Dead show, and it was because of my job. Tom thought it would be a good idea for me.
That was funny.
And Dean, our producer, Dean Metcalf, to go out to what the campground they used. Or did you guys let him use Deer Creek to camp?
We didn't let him camp on Deer Creek, but there was River
it was close
View by. Or someplace in Noblesville, I believe.
Yeah, that sounds right. And we went up there, and I think we slept in our car or something because we wanted to.
You went first class.
So we did that, and these hippies, Jeff.
These tell me about them.
Damn hippies! No, actually, I got out of a fist fight at this campground because I don't know. I might have said something in a smart aleck way, and someone took it the wrong way, and he was going to punch me in the face, and I. To get out of it, I go, hey. And Jerry Garcia had just died. And
well, would have been 95.
Was it 90?
Yep, 95, 94.
Yeah, it was right
about,
around.
About August 9th,
right around then. And can you be a little bit more exact on that date, Steve? I'd appreciate that. And I go, hey, man, what would Jerry do? As kind of a Hail Mary, and it worked. I mean, he almost started crying and wanted to hug me. It was great.
Let me tell you what's interesting about the Grateful Dead is – Grateful Dead were really unique as
they're a phenomenon.
As they were.
Yeah.
There was nothing else like that. There never will be. But they truly were in communication with their fans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what would happen with these campgrounds, they had a lady named – they called Calico, who I believe is still alive. She'd be in her 80s now. But she would go set up at the venue. She had a big RV and a couple of other people. And people would go to Calico – and they would say, hey, would you ask Phil Lesh this, or would you ask Mickey Hart that, or would you tell them this? And she would write it down. And then, okay, when am I going to see you next? Well, I'm going to be at the Chicago show, or I'm going to be at Great Woods, or I'm going to be – okay, I'm going to put – she cross-referenced it each way. Then she would go in and see the band each day. Calico would go in with her notebook.
It would actually
sit down right with the band on show day. And she would say, well, you know, Jeff over here had asked a question, Jerry, what do you think about this? Well, I think, boom, boom, okay. And then Chick asked this question here.
No kidding.
And then suddenly you go back and you're in Cleveland or you go to Denver. Hey, Calico, did you look this up? Let me look it up.
Ask Jerry this.
Here's Jerry's answer to this.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and they also had their Post-it board. They had a board with them. They called it the Wharf Rats. But you'd put Post-it notes on that would say, you know, hey, I'm going to, you know, meet you here, meet you there. And so they really communicated this. Think about this. This was back in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s.
Well, it's something that everyone –
they were communicating with bands.
Everyone – I mean, I guess Dane Cook is the most famous example in stand-up comedy where he used social media. Mm-hmm. And the Grateful Dead obviously was doing it.
Yeah, and I think so often you'd see these people sending letters to fan clubs, and you know, all too often you would see, you know, one of the things that always got me was just
nobody ever believed that those were actually answered by anybody or talked to, you know, right? Yeah,
all too often, like at shows, people would bring gifts, they'd bring cards, and you know, you leave them in the dressing room, and the band leaves, and they're still there.
Yeah, sadly, yeah.
By the way, Steve was right. August 9th, 1995, Jerry Garcia passed away. That's insane.
Good job. Good job, Steve. Okay, so Motley Crue, 1984. Mm-hmm. And then
– you know, a band I did a lot of shows with was Rat. And so
– Round and Round. You went round and round with
Rat,
them, didn't you? Yeah, that's what I thought.
So Rat was another example of a band that came kind of out of nowhere and went right up to that – headline status or level, and their opening act was Bon Jovi.
Hmm.
Now,
is that true?
Yes, on two tours.
I don't believe.
And
I don't
so
remember
this is good. So, Bon Jovi was managed by Doc McGee, who also managed
Any
Motley Crue.
No relation.
Okay.
And Doc now manages Kiss, and Doc actually was involved with Kiss years before, but he was also involved with Diana Ross. Doc McGee is a real legend and is in just period. And so we were always extra nice to the Bon Jovi guys, and they were always very nice back. I always liked those guys.
Mm-hmm.
So they opened for Rat in 84 and again in 85. And I always thought the guys in Rat treated the Bon Jovi guys bad. You know, I thought their crew was a little mean to them. I thought the guys in the band Rat were –
And you weren't just – you didn't think this up. You like saw evidence.
I was right there witnessing it.
You're right.
And so they all went off to play.
Tables Turn, Slippery When Wet comes out?
Yeah. Well, yes. So then suddenly here comes – and the Bon Jovi guys, they were always good. They were always great to work with. Mm-hmm. You know, John Bon Jovi's a smart guy.
I've always heard he's a sweet man and very intelligent.
I don't know how I would make the connection, but I would just love to go see him just to see if he'd remember me. I bet he would.
Mm-hmm. They're in town next month.
They're in town next month. Yeah. So Bon Jovi and Rat were invited both to play at the Donington Festival in England. I think, did I say that right? Maybe a big music festival. And Bon Jovi had made really good inroads in Europe, to the point where they were actually a headliner in Europe, mm-hmm. even though here they were still that, you know, where are we?
And I always opening for Rat.
Well, they, yeah. yeah. Well, they did some European dates together, and Rat was suddenly opening for Bon Jovi, and the Bon Jovi guys turned the screws at them.
Oh, yeah. It would be hard not to.
And then you fast forward to Slippery When Wet, and Bon Jovi came out as the opening act for 38 Special. Because 38 Special had their big album right then.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Hold On Loosely.
Hold On Loosely.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they noticed with Bon Jovi was something they sort of noticed with when Def Leppard opened for Billy Squire.
Oh,
was
my God.
Bon Jovi was selling a ton of T-shirts. And that was always a great little mark. But another thing that had happened was Slippery When Wet came out. And suddenly the other two Bon Jovi albums both jumped into, I think, the Billboard mm-hmm. Top 50. Mm-hmm. And a guy from their record label, Polygram, said this happened with Frampton Comes Alive. And they kind of paralleled that.
Right.
Because when Frampton Came Alive came out, his other two mm-hmm. solo albums were off, weren't there, and they suddenly jumped back in. And so here comes Bon Jovi as a headliner, massive headliner, massive production. The opening act was Skid Row.
Oh, my God!
Now, I saw John Bon Jovi one time clock Sebastian Bach, and he punched him right in the mouth. It was a million-dollar punch in Louisville, Kentucky. It was beautiful.
It had to be an uppercut because John's pretty small.
It was at Freedom Hall, and the way that there's this incline where you go down to the stage, and he just – He knocked him down on the ground with one shot.
Wow. Do you know what caused the punch?
What had happened was,
I mean, if Sebastian Bach is involved and he's the one getting punched, I totally understand it.
You know,
I think so many of these bands
I think get a little carried away, and I think that Sebastian Bach had been making.
Yeah.
When you're the opening act, you never want to criticize the headline act on stage, or never do anything stupid. If you want to look up the Black Crowes opening up for ZZ Top when Schlitz sponsored the tour. Look that one up of getting thrown off the tour and midway through the tour.
So the Crowes said something
about Schlitz.
Oh my God!
You're off. You're out
well,
of there.
Well, yeah.
But it was kind of and see what was interesting though. Doc McGee managed Bon Jovi, but his brother Scott managed Skid Row. So Skid Row kind of got some pretty good slots. You know, they opened for Guns N' Roses as well.
Yeah, when Skid Row opened for Guns N' Roses, that kind of nudged him. I mean, that was good news for Skid Row.
Let me see if I can word this just right.
Okay.
I think a lot of these rock bands can't get over things. I think the band Rat cannot get over the band Poison. Poison opened for Rat, by the way, in 87. So I don't think the band Rat ever got over the band Poison. I don't think the band Poison ever got over the band Motley Crue. I don't think that Motley Crue ever got over the band Metallica.
Now, is this...
This is my theory.
Is this you being around the bands and
I think just
what
when you just looked
politics?
At how things grew and really I don't think any of them could ever figure
that
out.
Makes sense. Yeah.
And yet here comes Guns N' Roses kind of doing an end round on them all.
Right. They didn't come. They did. Well, it's like stand up comedians. I mean, you MC, then you middle, and then you. Well, I guess you feature, and then feature. You headline. Yep. By God, and you don't. You don't do an end round, and yeah, I get you.
And you know, Guns came out, and Guns opened up for Aerosmith, But the writing was on the wall with Guns N' Roses. You just saw that happening. You really saw – you know, I think it was an interesting transition if you go back then, because you had two bands that were the real transition bands, Guns N' Roses and Pearl Jam. And think about this, and think about rock radio around 1991,
right? And that when they both came out with albums? Or wait,
Pearl Jam was 92. The albums had been out for about a year. It's Pearl just Jam. Radio
yeah, 10,
wasn't.
10 came out in 90?
Radio wasn't really playing them because you didn't 90. Have alternative radio.
And you suddenly saw
your standard rock radio. You really didn't hear Guns N' Roses on Q95 then. They weren't going to touch Pearl Jam.
Right.
Yeah,
now,
that's true.
They would play it late at night.
And X wasn't until – X really didn't come around until 93 or 94?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So
It was different before.
But you sort of had that interesting transition with it all and with those bands. And then suddenly you go into the 90s and you suddenly have the internet. And then suddenly these bands could all just write – have websites and talk about how great they are.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
And their fans – could communicate with them
and tell them
how great they are.
confirm
that they were great, even though that may be a fan in Lima, Peru, telling somebody, you know, sitting in.
Okay, you said that you saw John Bon Jovi punching Sebastian Bach. What else do you feel comfortable sharing with us along those veins? Along those lines.
Let's dig into this. So you would establish what you were doing. You're like, this is mm-hmm. what I'm going to do probably for the rest of my mm-hmm. life. Mm-hmm. What were your goals at that point? Did you have bigger goals?
I wanted to work for the company. Obviously, I guess if I would have loved to have been the actual promoter where it's my money, I'm going to make all this money, boom, boom, boom. And
there's a big risk in that, obviously. Right?
Well, there's so much risk now. And
that's the old Steve Martin joke. How do you make $1 million? Okay, first – you get $1 million. Then you take that.
You start with $2 million.
You start with $10 million, yeah, or whatever.
You start with $10 million and you end up with $1 million.
Yeah, that's right.
But,
yeah.
It's the days of somebody just coming out and promoting a show. There's such a small profit margin. Whereas now the promoters, the established promoters.
The correlation between how much work you're doing and how much money you're making, and I mean, I guess it would seem like it's a glamorous job, and you're selling tickets, mm-hmm. and you're working with rock and roll stars, and there's money going in, but it's really almost a zero-sum game. Right?
I remember so many times when I would go out and maybe cover, three or four shows at a time.
Produce and cover.
Like Cincinnati one night, going to Knoxville the next night, then Johnson City, Tennessee, and then maybe circling back.
And you're settling up with all these,
doing the settlement, doing all the numbers, soup to nuts,
the whole shit. Okay.
And there were so many times where I would just sit on an airplane, as an example, flying back, just thinking, "Oh my God, on these run of Kiss dates, I remember so well. We've lost over $100,000 between these three or four shows, real money. And God, am I going to get paid on Friday?
Every time, because
you'd hear stories. Well, the promoter in Tulsa, Oklahoma, can't pay his staff. This guy over here can't pay his staff, and. This promoter here in this market can't do advertising because he's in the rears, or this guy can't book shows because, he stiffed a band for
sure.
And Sunshine always paid their bills. It was miraculous. I think Dave and Steve suffered a lot.
I think they just
didn't pay themselves at times. For long periods of time. The key to being a promoter was it was wide open in the late 70s into the early 80s to be a concert promoter. But the smart promoters had to learn how to manage themselves. And by that, you had to get to the point where you could book a band, and typically when you book a band, it's a guarantee so much money and then so much of a percentage. Now, these days there are other variables into play. But when you get yourself established, you may not have to pay that deposit till a week or 2 weeks out. You get yourself established – you're able to buy radio and buy print on credit and not have to pay for it up front. You're able to mm-hmm. book Rupp Arena and maybe not have to pay a $10,000 deposit, but a $1,500 deposit. And so you learned how to manage yourselves really good,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's where that was, I think, the key with a lot of promoters. And then you suddenly saw the promoters, instead of paying a 50% deposit, paying a 10% deposit. Bill Graham started that one,
right,
as an example. But there were so many keys to it, yet everybody thought, is always under this impression, oh, they sold 10,000 tickets and the tickets were $25. That means the band made $250,000. No, the band was probably paid $50,000 and you know, and it cost this much and do that and this boom, boom, boom. And and then at the end of the day, there was, you know, another $100,000 to split up, and the band took 85% of it and the promoter took 15% of it. And, you know, bands made so much money off merchandise and still do. And, you know, when we were talking about Bon Jovi as an example – Bon Jovi sold so much merchandise. Mm-hmm. They actually had a tractor trailer of nothing but merchandise, and that was a constant revolving door of, you know, dump it and go
and go pick, and
we're
it up,
pick up
and
another more. We're going to pick up another load, and we're going to meet you in Pittsburgh, or we're going to meet you guys in New Jersey.
Wow.
But when Bon Jovi played at Rupp Arena in 1988, we sold it all the way around 23,500 tickets. It sold out. They went to Rupp Arena, his management, actually his merchandise company, which was Brockham. I don't know if they're still around now. They said to Rupp Arena, basically, what is the most amount of money you've ever made on T-shirt merchandise at a show? Tell us exactly how much it is. $45,000. The venue's cut. Here is $50,000. We're going to guarantee the arena. They were making more off that than they were renting the place. Here is $50,000. We want X amount of tables. We'll bring in our own sellers.
Just stay away from – here's your
and
cut.
That night,
just
that
stay
night,
away from
they did close to $300,000 in merch on a Saturday night.
On T-shirts.
In merch.
Merch.
Yeah. Jesus.
They did almost as much in merch as
– And that's back when a T-shirt was probably only 20 bucks.
Well, but something like that. But
yeah,
I mean,
in 88.
You know, this was back when you didn't – you know, you had – the shirts.
Well, there was no way. There wasn't a way to get a shirt.
No, there wasn't. The you weren't jumping online like I bought
the Ohio State
shirt online.
Yeah, you wait for the FedEx guy to show up. With
exactly.
Yeah.
So
was there a heyday of your profession that you talk about? You know, oh, back in the
because
the,
now you're not. I think you're not on the road like you were. Mm-hmm. Obviously,
I think my favorite year was probably '89.
Okay,
just because
Deer Creek
we opened up Deer Creek,
sure,
that year ended with doing two nights of the Rolling Stones at the Hoosier Dome.
Okay, and
I was there.
That was the only show my mother ever came
Steel
to.
Steel Wheels tour. Yeah.
So that meant so much to me that Stella was in the house.
That's cool.
And
did you get her a good seat?
Or? Well, she was up in the suite.
Oh.
And I was. I've got to tell you though, I was really humbled by so many people coming just to meet my mother.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people from radio, people from other venues, you know, the Market Square Arena guys just want to say hi to my mother. The people from Ticketmaster wanting to meet my mother. Christy Lee sat with my mother. My mother wanted her to marry me, and she did everything.
I don't know. I don't think I was well in 89.
Yeah.
I wasn't.
I mean, because
Chick McGee
Christy
then.
And my mother saw eye to eye.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, okay. They're both about, Christy sat with my mother up in the suite, and my buddy Ron Borthwick, and my Uncle Lucian, and my beautiful cousin Carol.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Son of a gun.
And so Rolling Stones with the opening act, Living Color.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that was.
I love Living Color.
And I think the night before was when the singer fell off the stage.
Oh, my gosh.
What's his face? Never.
And their bass player is now the bass player for the Rolling Stones.
Is he?
Yes. He played on those Jagger solo albums. But just working with the role, that was just such a high end. And really, what was interesting, though, was that night of the final night of the Rolling Stones was when I also got the final go-ahead call from the McCartney production, because we were putting Paul McCartney on sale the next week, and they had just built that show in Toronto, of all things. And you know, it was interesting. The Stones played and moved out, and McCartney and came to Indianapolis. McCartney rolled in and played. And they had opened some of the tour up there. But they still didn't have the production logistics down because then you were kind of doing it by hand. And a lot of times it was, let's build it and see what our sight lines are like, because McCartney, we could only sell it not so much a – it wasn't exactly a – you couldn't sell at 360, but it wasn't a 270 sell, and it wasn't a 180.
Mm-hmm.
It was just how much can we sell before we – before you can't see those video screens.
Right.
And so they were giving me – you know, I'm sitting there as my Stones – as the Stone Show is loading out on this telephone call with – But he's telling me, okay, I want you to
– Paul McCartney's guy. Right.
Here are the exact points, boom, boom, boom. And I'm suddenly thinking, wow, does it get any bigger than this?
Yeah.
You know, the Stones, here's Paul McCartney, yeah, okay, and this information here, you know, I've got to go sit down with Ticketmaster and go to Market Square Arena actually and finalize it. And it was just – felt – it was just like what a way to end the year.
Yeah. Were you – how close were you to the Ticketmaster, Pearl Jam – what the hell's going on with tickets?
I wasn't. And, you know, I think.
I mean, I know you were right there, but you were an interested observer, but, you know, well, a knowledgeable observer.
Here's my take on it. Don't take on a billionaire unless you're a billionaire.
Yeah.
And when Pearl Jam tried to do their own ticketing, it was a disaster, period. And, you know, it's funny. Selling tickets online was one of the first forms of e-commerce that we saw that people mm-hmm. were comfortable doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, what Pearl Jam was running into was they were wanting to only play venues that were not Ticketmaster venues. Well, probably half the venues in the country were Ticketmaster venues. Because
right.
let's face it, Ticketmaster has a great product. Ticketmaster also, what people don't realize is when you see these ticketing fees, you all think, well, you know, not only did my ticket cost $50, but then this convenience
fees.
Charge, this was $4 and that was $3 and that was $3. What they don't realize is, yeah, and there's where Ticketmaster makes their money. And, oh, and then they charge 3% for the credit card transaction. Yeah, and see, Ticketmaster kind of made a little bit of money there. But see, out of these convenience charges, the venue is getting half or three quarters of that. The promoter is getting a piece of it, and the band is getting a piece of it.
Right.
And see, so Ticketmaster was always really good at just not saying and you know, if you want to see proof of that, go to a Ticketmaster venue and buy a $50 – let's just say the arena here. Go buy a – Bankers Life Fieldhouse.
Bankers Life.
Go buy a $50 Pacers ticket. Go buy a $50 Bon Jovi ticket. Go buy a $50 circus ticket. And go buy a $50 wrestling ticket.
Okay, that's $200
amount. And you're going to have four different service charges.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, yeah. Totally different.
And it may be only by a quarter or 50 cents or a dollar here, but you're going to see. But
they're all going to be different.
So, but I think, you know, I admire what Pearl Jam tried to do. But I wonder how much money they really lost at the end of the day, and I wonder what they
They made some. To me, and I was in on Pearl Jam. I still am. I love Pearl Jam. Mm-hmm. But they started a fight where I didn't think there was really a problem to start with.
And then they were wanting to try to do field shows. We actually looked at trying to do them in the parking lot at Deer Creek, and it just you know, and in a way, I think they were just best to just kind of drop it and go out and just play the music and do it well. And if
I will say, though, that little ruffle did provide me and technically Chick, because we were at the same show, March 17th, 1994, Elliott Hall of Music.
West Lafayette, Indiana.
Purdue University.
Incredible show.
Because I don't think they would have come there because it was not a Ticketmaster venue.
Neither was Louisville Gardens.
Yeah, so
it was a beautiful and great sound. Man, it sounded great.
It did.
You, Ace, and 40. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't – obviously, we didn't know each other yet. But
oh, that's right.
It was a year before I met you, actually.
Yeah. Marty. Marty, Ace.
I was there as a student.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But, you know, Pearl Jam, when they came out, they had such tight deals that if you know, when you make a concert deal, you've got not only – you have to list out all the expenses that come into play. And a lot of times it's based on estimates. But if you had estimated $5,000 for something and the real cost of it was $8,000, Pearl Jam wasn't letting you put that into settlement. You were having to eat that money.
Good luck trying to get the $3,000.
We had a mistake made on our date when we had Pearl Jam in Louisville Gardens of $3,500, and the band wouldn't permit it, and it was over half of our profit from a sold-out show. So
Pearl Jam right there wasn't making friends with people who are they're going to need book them later
this
on.
Was, but so you know,
was that a Kelly, was that a Kelly Curtis thing?
It may have been. I mean, I think Kelly
That's
Curtis
Pearl Jam's man.
Managed yeah, another band. I think they could just do it because they could.
Okay.
Yeah. Period. You know, there's a reason. And as much as I think so many of these other bands want to fall in that, there's only one Pearl Jam. There's only one Fish. There's only one Dave Matthews.
There's only one John Mayer.
There's only one John Mayer. But I'm saying I think when you get to that, there's only one Jimmy Buffett. You can really dictate everything.
So what is it like? What is it like now? Is it mostly casinos and corporation business? Is that what you're doing for you?
A little bit, mostly corporate stuff.
Yeah,
you know, I've got a client in Fort Wayne that I do a monthly thing with.
You've been,
I've done a lot of club stuff too.
In a tough business, you are a survivor, and you. What did you celebrate your 25th year on your own, or what was it?
October was my.
You can tell how important it is.
2004,
to me.
So it is. Yeah, my twelfth year. I'm twelve and a half years on my own. I did take a break last summer, and I volunteered as a sales rep at Tom Wood Jaguar.
That's right. Only because he wanted to drive
months,
a Jaguar.
Yeah, for 6 months, I volunteered.
Yeah, and you had a great time.
Yeah, and I lost 40 pounds.
Well, there you go.
Wow.
Now he works out, and now what can you? Can you tell us about any shows coming up? Any sneaky shows?
I really don't have the sneaky things.
You're a corporation. You do corporate shows.
Yeah. So I don't have that big concert announcement. But I think we're in the mode where it seems like every week you're not seeing a show announced. You're seeing multiple shows of multiple genres announced. You know, I look at Indianapolis now and just there's something going on seemingly just about every day.
Yep.
You know, it's hard to look at our city
it's
and say
there's – It's crazy how much
– that's have, here. Imagine being in Chicago.
Exactly. And you know, when you – it's really interesting. You look at several times last year, last summer especially, when you had a show going on at Klipsch Music Center. You had a show going on at The Lawn and at Bankers Life Fieldhouse. Three shows in the same night. And that happened a couple times last year.
I think – I'm trying to – I was at one show at The Lawn, and I'm trying to remember who it was. Ray LaMontagne. Maybe.
He's been there a couple times.
Yeah. Is that who it was? And I remember it was okay, but not having that great of a time.
I agree. The sound there.
The sound is.
Well, keep something in mind, though. When you got a show there, for the most part, those are bands bringing in their own production. Mm. Just like when you see something up at Klipsch Music Center, that's the whole traveling production with the band.
Okay.
That's not here's our house PA. And something else to keep in mind, I think there's a big difference with each show being unique among them, to themselves, their own sound man, and, you know, just sometimes maybe it's just not working. Maybe it's just not working where you're from your vantage point, from where you're at in the venue there. But that's something that a lot of people don't realize. Just like if you remember when Bankers Life Fieldhouse opened up, my buddy Dave Lindquist wrote a story about Springsteen not sounding right. Yeah. And it didn't sound good up there because what had happened was the Springsteen camp wouldn't let them turn on their speakers to supplement now, which they, of course all the bands do now because they thought they could hit that upper level with their own PA. And bands were always conscious of, oh, is somebody sneaking a recording of it? You know, like I said one time at Deer Creek, yeah, you're right. We built a $14 million venue just so we could try to sneak a recording of your artist and sell it for $10 online. Yeah, right.
That's exactly what you're on to.
Even though I don't even know how to get online, you're right. Yeah, we're going to make bootleg copies of this. Give me a break. But you know, I get that. But you know, one of the things that came out was, well, gee, they played a Steely Dan song. Yes, there is the one song off Asia is the song that most sound engineers used to tune and fire up a PA.
Right.
So, you know, it happens.
One show I wanted to ask you about, I wasn't there, but Pink Floyd at the Dome. Mm-hmm. Did you book that one?
Belkin Productions did that.
Okay.
And
Momentary Lapse of Reason tour. Yeah. I was there with the
big circle of
light.
I loved to see
that. Somebody jumped off the balcony.
Yes.
Yes.
Learning to fly?
I did. Yeah.
I think so.
There was something like I did. That. I was there and I had no idea it happened. Yeah, until the next day, I heard a report of it. Yeah,
yeah, and just you know,
some dumbass kid.
You know, you know, the tough
probably some dim hippie on acid.
You know, it's the tough thing is when you have a big crowd, you have a lot of security, and crowds can become unruly. But typically, it's just one or two people that can really screw it up.
Yep.
Are you in charge of security? Doing used to be when you were in the meatballs.
When I was doing meat and potatoes. That was part of a show advance. Was going through.
Okay.
You know, going through your stagehand calls and your production advance with the venue and the staging. You got your catering. You got your security. You've got your settlement. You know, that was just part of the protocol there, and you would work. And you know, it was always a big difference at times. You know, there was a vast difference. Like here, we always had a really good peer security company. Now it's called ESG, but back then it was the Bear Force, if you think about it.
Do you remember a guy named – first name was – I remember Papa Bear. John, who works in security?
Hang on a second.
You'll know who I'm talking about.
You know John in security.
bald-headed guy, works with John Mellencamp a lot, actually.
That's actually it's not John.
It's Joe. Joe, that's it. You're exactly right, Joe Robinson.
Joe Robinson is great. I think the world of Joe Robinson.
Great guy.
Joe has just done great things with that company, and just a great. Joe is a smart guy.
I want Joe to hear that. I've always sang the praises of Joe. Love that guy.
He's just Joe's always been a good friend. You know,
that's exactly
tough
right.
times. Joe was there at Joe. Times actually, and just always a good guy. We used some of his guys last Saturday for Aretha actually, but
no kidding.
But you know, you go back into the 80s and 90s. You know, it was. You know, it was tough, like doing a heavy metal show, like a Motley Crue show or an AC/DC show, in a Knoxville, Tennessee, where you didn't have a regular core of security people. I remember one time a guy saying to AC/DC's security director, "Hey, man, this is just a hobby of mine. Don't yell at me."
So what are you?
Well, you can let the Hell's Angels come in, and they can like, do security for the. That works out well.
Then you have that.
I just finished reading that book, Altamont.
Yeah.
By the way,
a lot of stabbing.
Yes or no question? Have you ever gotten Ace Cosby into a show?
Oh my god! You know the tough
well,
thing.
Well, no, wait a minute. How about this? Has Ace Cosby ever gotten you into a show? No, I don't think
he owes so. You.
You know, the tough thing that would happen with when me and Ace were together is we looked alike and people couldn't tell us apart.
That's the thing.
And so that was always the problem.
Steve Girardi, concert promoter legend.
Can we have dinner sometime?
You know, I've got to get going though.
I have dinner with this gentleman. I want to be there. It's part of my Christmas celebration.
I
want to
have dinner with Steve.
We do that.
You came over last week, Chick.
I did. I was there for. I was at Steve's house for the Super Bowl.
That's
party.
Right. Yeah,
we had a great time.
I mean, I had
the best Super Bowl party food I've ever had.
Thank you.
The rotini, and he makes a gravy that's incredible.
We had a judge, we had an attorney, we had a PR person, personalities, and a priest, and a Catholic priest.
Italians call their marinara gravy.
I don't.
Gravy. I know you don't. I don't care. Speaking of food, hey, you know Blue Apron, proud sponsors of the Chick McGee Show. They're the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the United States of America. Blue Apron established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers all across the United States. And as a result, Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. and 99.5% of Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for the recipe. It comes right to your door. And did you know that this is a fun activity for you and the kids?
Mm-hmm.
I always remember that my daughter, when she was a baby girl, she would help Daddy cook. It wasn't Blue Apron then, but it would be now. Of course, she's... Let me see. How old is she? She'll be 24. She's a little older. But we used to say, "Dump in, Daddy." But you can do that with your Blue Apron box. It all comes. You cook it up, and bang, you've got dinner for you and the kids. And
there's a code, right, Chick?
Yep, there is a code.
BlueApron.com/McGee, I believe. Right.
There is a code. It's blueapron.com/McGee. Please use that code.
How do you spell McGee?
MCGEE. blueapron.com/McGee to get your Blue Apron shipped to your house. And this week, how about a cashew chicken stir fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice?
Yes, please.
It is quality. And it's stuff you wouldn't necessarily cook yourself.
No.
But man, they do it right and you have just the exact ingredients. Stuff you might not have, but you don't have any waste.
How many times have you stood in the grocery store and what am I going to cook for dinner tonight? It all is delivered to your home. And remember, blueapron.com/McGee for a better way to cook. That's Blue Apron. Thank you, Steve, for stopping by. Buddy, I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, guys.
All right. We're going to do this at least once every 5 or 6 years.
Okay. I'll come up with some new material.
All right. Yep.
I'm guessing we didn't even scratch the surface.
Oh, no. We only had one punch in the whole thing.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, JeffyBear.com.
Thank you, Jason.
Absolutely.
This is the Chick McGee Show on Podcast One. Good night, everybody.
There's nothing like the thrill of a last-second victory. That buzzer beater from 20 feet out. The game-winning field goal that just makes it as the clock ticks down. That great limited-time deal on a new 2017 Volkswagen at the Volkswagen Model Year End Event. We need to make room for the 2018s, so this could be your last chance to get a great deal on select 2017 Volkswagen models. Visit your nearest Volkswagen dealer for a test drive today. But hurry, because the clock is ticking and we can't call time out.
Virginia buries its dead. I'm Rita Foley with an AP News Minute. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe is talking about President Trump's response to the violence in Charlottesville over the weekend at a white supremacist rally.
Those remarks are dividing people. We cannot be dividing people.
Governor McAuliffe told CBS this morning he knows two of the three people who were killed that day.
I have lost three great citizens yesterday, Heather Heyer's funeral. Tomorrow we will have to put to rest Trooper Burke Bates, who had been part of my executive protection detail, and then on Saturday, Lieutenant Jay Cullen, who'd been my pilot. This breaks your heart.
Heather Heyer died when a car rammed a group of protesters. The two Virginia state troopers were killed while monitoring the rally when their helicopter went down. Prison visitations are off at a state facility or all state facilities in Florida, where they say they have credible intelligence indicating some sort of security threat. There are no details available yet. I'm Rita Foley.